It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 202 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This episode will be slightly longer than normal as I wrap up my coverage of the New York Comic Con with three great interviews. But first, we'll hear from Russell Nolte, creator of such wonderful things as Katrina Hates the Dead and Ichabod Jones and many other good things. He discusses how he's going to help creators use Kickstarter and other crowdfunding methods, as well as talking about his current projects. Then we get to New York Comic Con. First up are Prez creators Ben Caldwell and Mark Russell as they talk about their comic. Then we visit Vertigo as Lauren Bucus and Dale Halverson talk about Survivors Club. Then everything wraps up with Jeff King talking about Convergence and Telus. Once again, there's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. I'm talking today with Russell Nolte, the creator of Katrina Hates the Dead, which had recently completed a successful Kickstarter campaign and has done many other things, including Ichabod Jones and many other good things. So that's good. There's lots of good things that you're doing. So how are you doing today?
Doing all right.
Good.
We've been plugging on all cylinders since we launched Wannabe Press in June. Mm-hmm. So it's been a long, exciting road. Our con season is now over, so it's nice to have a little bit of downtime to hang out with the family again.
That's good. Now, I'm so interested because you've had these publications. Now you're releasing them on this Wannabe Press. Is it like every day you put another page or another panel out? How's that work?
Sure. It started with just me. Mm-hmm. I put out one page of Ichabod Jones every week, and then one page of my other book, Gherkin Boy, which I draw. And then we opened up submissions, and we were flooded with submissions. So now we have 15 comics that update throughout the week. We've got a couple of dailies. We've got sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and comic strips. So we have a whole day devoted just to comic strips. Mm-hmm. Which is Sundays, just like the Sunday funnies you remember. Mm-hmm. And then Mondays and Fridays are fantasy, Tuesdays and Thursdays are sci-fi, Wednesdays are horror, and then Saturdays an anthology, which happens to right now be sci-fi.
Oh, cool. That's cool. So you said this started in June. Do you want to give people the web address?
Sure. It's www.wannabepress.com. It's W-A-N-N-A-B-E, press.com.
And unless you're overwhelmed, how do people submit things to you?
Well, right now, we're not accepting anything this year.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably going to open submissions up around March or April. Mm-hmm. Everything that happens to us, though, happens through webcomic first. Mm-hmm. So we are webcomic first because that's how I feel like the best way to build an audience.
Mm-hmm.
A person has to have at least 50 strips done or 50 days worth of comics done before we will consider them. Because that's 6 months is how long it takes for us to build a comic audience.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you guys print them after that? Or is it just stay on the webcomic thing?
Well, I mean, it depends. Creators have 100% control of the and retain 100% of creative control and ownership of the webcomic.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as it stays on the web until it prints, they can do anything they want with it. They can bring it to 50 different sites if they want. 100 different sites, however they want to do it. Once they print is once they find an audience, and then we do take domestic print rights, but they still have international print rights.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it really depends. It also depends on how much of an audience we can build. So our first book that we did that wasn't mine was Convenience Store Diet,
mm-hmm.
and it had 5 years of comics worth of audience build.
Wow.
So it does very well when we go to shows. People respond to it. They like it. They like it both on the digital side and the print side. So people have been very, very receptive to that book. And that's what we want for everyone that we do print. You know, so many people and so many companies will print a book without having a good plan or having any marketing behind it or even having an audience behind it. And we don't want to do that. We want to make sure that when we print a book, we are going to be able to deliver an audience for that creator.
Very good. Now, the name of the website is based on a project you worked on initially, isn't it?
Yeah. Originally, the first book I ever did was called The Wannabes, which was a superhero team-up. And I always loved the book. I always wanted to do something else with it. And this kind of fit, because I've always felt, and I think a lot of people do, I always feel like, you know, you're on the outside looking in. Like, I wanted to be a director, and I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to work in comics. You're always outsiders looking in. So our website, Wannabe Press, is like, are you a wannabe? That's our big end slogan.
It was really good. I looked at some of them. I got a chance to read some of your Ichabod Jones and your other one, which were kind of fun to read. They're very interesting and very different, which I like. In fact, as I got a chance to look over your writing overall, it's all usually something that I haven't read before, which is really good because I as a longtime comics reader, I've read a lot of stuff. And so I always cherish something when it's new and I haven't read it before. So I like that quite a lot. So I'm very pleased.
Thank you. And that's sort of the philosophy of our whole company is we want to do things that are weird and explore comics in a way that they haven't been explored maybe before or not a lot before. Most people, when they think of comics, they think of superheroes, tights, spandex, fighting a bad guy. But comics are so much more than that. They're just like any other medium. That's why whenever someone says, oh, I don't like comics, I say, that's a weird thing to say. I mean, if you just dissect it, it's a weird thing to say, right? I mean, nobody says, I don't blanketly like movies, or I don't blanketly like music, or I don't blanketly like TV. Like, nobody would ever make that claim, right?
Right.
However, for some reason with comics, people can make a claim, I don't like comics, which to me always means I don't like superhero comics, or I don't like the kind of comics that people show me, which are the very popular comics. But there are thousands of comics which you might like if you expanded your horizon, and people like some of my friends and a lot of my friends, a lot of awesome people in the industry are expanding people's minds to do things in comics that they may not have done before.
We need more of that, to be honest with you. There are so many Long John's books out there that I have read almost every imaginable story. Now, there are still some people who are coming up with new things when it comes to superhero stuff, but that's kind of rare. So to see something new and different to me is quite the pleasure, so I really like that.
Thank you very much.
Why don't we go ahead and get to Katrina Hates the Dead, which I love the description on the Kickstarter. It said, Katrina hates living in the apocalypse, so she sets out to kill the devil and send his hellspawn back to the abyss where they belong.
Yes.
Now, that's a little different, too. I like that because, you know, The Walking Dead is percolating along, and zombies and good things like that are very popular these days. I always like to say that zombies are the new vampires. But yours has got a different take on it, and I like it a lot. Why don't you talk a little bit more about what the concept is?
Sure. So I think the apocalypse is hilarious. I think maybe it's the most hilarious, most absurd thing that's ever existed, and we just kind of take it with a grain of salt that it's a thing, right? So, backtracking a second, the idea of heaven and hell and all this is kind of ridiculous, because if you believe in God, you by definition have to believe in the devil, right? So, in order to believe in God, the monotheistic God that Christianity believes in, you have to believe that he's all-knowing and all-powerful, right? That is a thing you must blanketly believe. However, even though he's all-powerful and he made angels in his image and all of these other things, you are making a claim that God can't kill the devil in a second. I mean, by the snap of his fingers. That's a ludicrous claim, number one. Like, just the fact that there's a thing, if God is all-powerful, by definition, he has to be able to stop the devil with the snap of his fingers. Otherwise, he's not all-powerful. So if the devil is allowed to exist, he does it at the behest of God and with the tacit approval of God.
Mm-hmm.
So I say that to say that Katrina is about this girl who's been in the apocalypse. It's a biblical apocalypse. Mm-hmm. All the good boys and girls have been raptured to heaven. All the bad ones have been destroyed by these demons and hellspawn over the last couple years.
Mm-hmm.
And she's survived on hell in the apocalypse while all these hellspawn are basically destroying everything.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, the hellspawn decide that they've had enough. And they just start chilling out. They start squatting in the homes of the people they once murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they work for really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So they start taking the jobs of these people that are already miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, Katrina's had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And Katrina is blindly raging along. So she's filled with blind rage and this idea that she has to kill the devil. Because that will end everything.
Mm-hmm.
And everything in the book is about this blind rage that she has. The fact that she may be doing more harm than good doesn't matter to her. The fact that the devil may or may not be the bad guy doesn't matter to her.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that she's hurting people, places, and things that are real doesn't matter to her. All that matters is that she sets out to hell. She kills the devil, and she'll believe anything that helps her along the way
mm-hmm.
to the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And she will disregard anything that is not moving her forward.
Mm-hmm.
So while it is an action story, we do a lot of sacrilegious stuff in the book,
mm-hmm.
bring a lot of all that stuff up to the surface. I'm a lapsed Catholic.
Okay.
So like, there's a lot of that like anger and confusion built into my life, just like most lapsed Catholics' lives.
Okay.
And that's where all of this stuff starts. So it is an action horror comedy book,
mm-hmm.
but it is much more than that because we take a lot of character moments. There's a lot of mixed emotions for people. For instance, Connie, who's Katrina's best friend, her father was raptured to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a complete jerk.
Mm-hmm.
So she's dealing with the fact that somehow she wasn't raptured,
mm-hmm.
even though he was, and he was awful.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these things that are percolating under the surface of this book,
mm-hmm.
whereas that you can look for
mm-hmm.
if you want to, but if you just want to have an adventure, action, killing monsters ride, you can do that too.
Now, this is a trade paperback, right?
Yes.
Okay. How many pages in it, do you remember?
Total pages is 116.
Okay.
And then there's 22, because it's 136 total, so there's 20 pages of additional content.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer in if you're going to pick up a trade,
mm-hmm.
it needs to be more than just the book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as much as I love Brian K. Vaughan's stuff,
mm-hmm.
it pains me every time I go to pick up a book of Saga
mm-hmm.
or his old books, Why the Last Man, and there's literally the last page at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like process stuff. I like pinups. I like fan art. I like a script of final page, alternate covers, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think is important to make people want to pick up the trade as opposed to saying, well, I could just read this online.
Mm-hmm. Now, did this start out as a webcomic?
No, it didn't.
Okay.
We started the webcomic portion of this
mm-hmm.
in June, so it's never been online as of yet.
Okay. You said this comes from some of your background and stuff. As far as doing the project and choosing an artist and stuff, I've been reading some of your articles when people interview and ask you about the creative process. And one of the things you said was to make sure you have the right artist. And I'm sure you followed your own advice. How did you pick the artist for Katrina Hates the Dead?
I have a very careful selection process.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a little bit different because I know so many artists. I can go to the ones that I know I can trust. But mm-hmm. back when I was starting, what I would do is cast a huge net to everybody. Back then, DeviantArt was a lot bigger than it was now. Digital webbing was a lot bigger than it was now. Pencil Jack. But now the same thing can be done on Facebook groups or
mm-hmm.
Twitter conversations, those sorts of things where you can just post out in forums, hey, I'm looking for an artist. Here's the project. Get back to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would look, hundreds, 500, 600 people would respond, maybe, not a big one. Mm-hmm. And I would pick out the ones that I liked, and then I would have them do a test page. Mm-hmm. The ones I liked, they would all do a test page, mm-hmm. and the ones that came back, then I would choose between, and I would keep doing that until I found the artist that I really, really, really believed in. Mm-hmm. And that did a couple of things. By being so persnickety about it, mm-hmm. Most of my friends have a horror story about an artist who started working with them, mm-hmm. and they loved the work, and then they paid and nothing ever got done. Mm-hmm. Knock on wood, have never had that problem, because by making them do a test page and making them work for it, mm-hmm. I knew which ones really loved the book. Mm-hmm. The second thing that it does is it gets somebody who really loves the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, my artist for Katrina, he now works for Dark Horse and Avatar. He has an agent. He's completely swamped. Mm-hmm. And that's what will happen if you pick the right artist, because they're on the upswing of their career.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah, so they're on the upswing of their career, and they're going to get an offer from somebody better. Mm-hmm. So you better love the book. Mm-hmm. They better love the book when you start. Otherwise, never going to get finished, and there's nothing worse than having an artist that cuts out in the middle of a project.
Oh, I can just think how awful that must be.
Oh, it's terrible. My friend had one. They left after the first issue, and he's been trying for 5 years. He finished the book with another artist, and every person takes it to pretty much is like, well, yeah, this is great, but you have to redo the whole first issue. And who's got an extra thousands of dollars that it would cost to redo 30 pages of artwork?
Yikes. Well, I'm glad you got the person you did, because the graphics that I see of it, I really like. I think it's a really well-designed comic. Now, of course, back to the Kickstarter. You ended up with 294 backers who pledged $8,780. I was just kind of curious, how much did you originally ask for?
$5,000.
Okay, so wow. You did really good. You got about 50% more than what you originally asked for, which is really good.
We got 160% we got 180% was it 180% more backers and 160% more than what we did last year.
Cool.
For our first book.
Okay. So this is the second book then?
Yeah, because Ichabod was last year and then Katrina was this year.
Oh, so gotcha.
We raised $5,500 last year and $8,800 this year. And we had 163 backers last year and then 294 this year. So that's quite an increase year over year for a book that's completely standalone.
Yeah, very good. Well, that's a real accomplishment on Kickstarter, because, you know, not every project makes it. And as much as I love Kickstarter and I think it's a real important thing, sometimes I'm real sorry when some things don't get through and they don't get their money, because you can't get a fraction of anything. You got to completely meet your goal.
Yeah, I mean, what I find, and that's why we're starting Kickstarter University, mm-hmm. is our new initiative to teach people how to use Kickstarter and, you know, other crowdfunding, is because great content's a given. I mean, you could go to Kickstarter right now and there's probably around 200 comics, of which at least 150 of them are very worthy of being funded. But the way that people go about funding them and the way people go about creating their Kickstarters and creating the message of their Kickstarter and then marketing their Kickstarter as it goes through the process is completely backwards. And that's because they're not sales and marketing people. They're artists and writers and directors and producers. Like, these are people that don't spend their living trying to get money from people. And in fact, most of the time, people make them feel bad for wanting to get money for the project. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the idea that somebody would even dare make a Kickstarter and have their goal inclusive of their page rate is a very squeamish topic for some people. Mm-hmm. However, asking someone to do a commission or something else, or asking somebody to pay for a drone, nobody would ever think, if you were selling a consumer tech project on Kickstarter, no one would ever think that you wouldn't go and try and raise money to include your own costs for yourself, right?
Right.
But when you talk about a comic or a movie or a TV show or a book, it's an abhorrent thing in our culture that somebody would dare want to make a living on this thing through their medium of choice. So a lot of it is spent showing people, hey, you don't have to work for free, And the fact that we all think that we have to work for free is a problem inherent in the system. And it's how people are taking advantage of us. Not our fans. I don't think our fans do it, and I don't think that our fans do it intentionally. Mm-hmm. But it is a flaw inherent in the system that people do take advantage of us as creators. And then because they're taking advantage of us and they're making us feel bad that we want to make a living doing this, we ask for less than what we're worth. And we say, oh, well, I made a little bit more on my Kickstarter and I actually could pay my mortgage this week with it, this month with it. That's bad. I need to do more. I need to buy more copies. I need to buy this other thing. I need to do more stuff. And all of that prevents us from putting together a successful Kickstarter campaign that can be marketed and sold effectively to the most amount of fans.
Well, it's great that you're doing that because everybody seems to have to learn on the fly, and not everybody picks it up. So if somebody wants to go through your process there, how do they do that?
Well, we're setting up our website now. Right now, what I recommend is they email me at russell@wannabepress.com, which is my personal email from the website, and then I can tell them a little bit about what's going on. Starting, we're hoping before December 1st, but by December 1st, we're going to launch KickstarterUniversity.com, which is going to have all of our web content. We're going to have 8 mini webinars, which are about 8 to 15 minutes long, and they're going to go everything from, I just recorded one that was how to set up a campaign people want to back, all the way through what to do after you're finished and how to distribute your book, and then how to market, how to set backer rewards, what Kickstarter is or what is crowdfunding total, where I break down all of the different kinds of crowdfunding platforms. These are little, quick, 10 to 15 minute blurbs that you'll be able to get a lot of focused information in a very short amount of time.
Well, these days, Kickstarter and like Indiegogo and places like that are just vital. I don't know how independent creators can make it without these kinds of things.
And honestly, crowdfunding is a great landing page. But the bigger thing and the bigger part of this is you have to market yourself. And you can do one of two things. Either you can be a struggling artist who has a day job and usually, not always, there are some creators who generally love their day job, but most creators are less than satisfied with their day job, and they take all of their money and they use the money from their day job to fund their art. And you can do that without learning how to market yourself. You can hate your day job and then just come home and do art and post it online and have no audience. Or you can build your audience through Kickstarter and then using methods that we talk about. You can build your audience and then eventually make enough money where you can do this as a job full time because you have a big enough audience. It doesn't happen overnight, but there's certainly, if you have a big enough audience, you build it properly and you set things out and you learn marketing and sales. Is that part horrible for most creators and writers and artists? Yes, the marketing is horrible. But is it less horrible than having a soul-crushing day job? I would say no. I mean, what would you say?
If you love your work, they always say that if you love your job, you don't work a day in your life.
Right.
So if you want to be able to be a comics creator full time, then I would say now is the time to jump in and make that a go. You can always get other jobs. Granted, the economy is not the best, but you can always get. Now's the time. If you have a good project and a good idea, now's the time to do it rather than wait until later and then maybe somebody else will come up with something that's like your project and you don't get to do it. So,
I mean, just starting now and learning to do it. I mean, I'm on the bandwagon of I did not want to learn marketing and sales at all. I hated it. There were two things that I was never going to be in my life. One was a writer and one was a salesperson. And those are the two things that I do now and I love more than anything because the word marketing and sales is a negatively connotated word, right? People don't like to think about marketing and sales, especially the word marketing. People cringe when you're right and go, oh, God, I don't want to do marketing. I don't want to bug my fans and my friends and my family to buy my thing. That's gross, right? But if you actually think about it, marketing is really just telling people about your book. And if they like it, they'll buy it. It may bug some people. I mean, McDonald's bugs some people, a lot of people. But they also have an enormous marketing budget because they know the biggest company in the world, Coca-Cola, Apple, they know that they have to pour tons of money into marketing so that people remember who they are. And it has to be different marketing. The number one thing that I hear from creators is, oh, nobody buys my book. Do you hear that ever?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So, but then the next follow-up question is, oh, really? How much marketing do you do? How many shows do you do? And they go, none. One a year. I'm like, well, of course nobody buys your book, brother. Like, nobody knows the book exists. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a ton of marketing and no one buying your book, okay, there may be a flaw with the book. But if you're not doing it, if you're not telling people about it, then the flaw may be either in the book or in the creator because they're too scared to tell people about it. So that's sort of where I'm at, what we're trying to do. And we're working with a lot of creators right now. And a lot of it is getting them over the fear of, oh, God, people are going to hate me if I tell them about my book. And then they come to me after the Kickstarter. I tell them, no, they're not going to hate you. They're going to love and support you. And if they hate you for posting about your Kickstarter, then you should unfriend them right now, because life's goal is to get people who are on the same journey as you, who like the things that you say and are going to support you. There's 7 billion people in this world. You've got to be able to find 50,000 or 10,000 that'll like the thing you have to say, even if it's the worst thing ever. So a lot of it is literally just mentally telling people they will not hate you. They will support you. They love you. People want to get new content. People want to find new things like you. Like most people are like you. They want new content. They want to see things that are cool, that they like, that will resonate with them. They may not buy your book day one the first time they see it, but they might sign up for your mailing list. They might like your fan page. They might start looking at stuff online. And then they might buy in a year from now or 2 years from now, and then they'll buy everything that you do forever once you get that. But it is a slow, rejection-filled process that is horrible. I mean, I love it, but it takes a long time to build up that skin of like, oh, maybe 1% of people will like my book. Maybe. That's still a huge amount. How many people are in America? 400 million? Take 1% of 400 million. That's still 4 million people. That's still 4 times more than the amount of people that buy Stephen King's books, because he sells about a million copies. Right? I mean, think about that. Stephen King's one of the most influential, best-known creators in the world ever, and he sells a million, maybe a couple million copies worldwide, which means that he's selling less than 0.1% of the worldwide population on his book. 99.9% of people in this world don't like Stephen King's work enough to buy it.
Wow.
That's a staggering number.
Right. Right.
And when you sort of flip that number around and you go, yeah, but Stephen King sells 2 million, 4 million, 70 million books, however, whatever the amount is, you're still like, yeah, that's his entire catalog. He sold 70 million books. That means in the entire course of life, of his hundreds of books, he's sold 70 or 100 million. That's a really terrible ratio. When you think of just how many human beings are on this earth and that a lot of them are repeat buying all of his stuff. And you're like, yeah, so he sold 100 million books. How I look at it is 99.9% of people won't even consider buying a Stephen King book. And he's still one of the most prolific, best-known authors ever.
That sounds really good, and I we need that kind of thinking, to be honest with you. So why don't you once again say how people get in touch with you about the Kickstarter University?
Sure. So right now, until the beginning of December, people can email russell@wannabepress.com, or they can go to info, or they can find me online. I'm a very, very present everywhere. You spell my name. I am public on Facebook. All of my Twitter handles and Pinterest are all at either at Russell Nolte or at Wannabe Press. Very easy to find. www.wannabepress.com. They can email me any questions they have or comment on any of my stuff, and I'll see it. Then Kickstarter University is going to be set up in the next month or so, and then you'll be able to get all sorts of free content, webinars, mini webinars and then live webinars that we do throughout the week. Mm-hmm. And then also one-on-one coaching if you choose to go that route.
Now, why don't you spell your last name? Because it sounds like Nolte, but it's spelled how?
Yes, it's Nohelty. That's November Oscar Henry Edgar Larry Tom Yo-Yo.
Okay. So that'll
and
be good.
Remember, two S's and two L's.
Right, and Russell. So that'll be good. Yeah, it really sounds like something that people could really benefit from. So I'm hoping people will take the opportunity and approach you and get the good training that they need in order to make these things happen.
I hope so, because there's so much good content. Like, the ideas have never been easier to do, to execute well, and to get out there and to build your audience. I mean, any writer who was coming up 20 years ago would kill for the kinds of platforms that they have now.
Right.
Plus, print on demand is incredibly cheap. Finding a printer and finding collaborators is very, very cheap comparatively to the $100, $200, $300 a page you had to pay previously, and then handing them out one at a time at conventions. So please, our goal is to show you how to go from your awesome idea or your completed idea, whether it's a movie, TV show, comic, or whatever, into figuring out how to market it right, strategically planning your book, so that by the end of it, you use it not only to fund your book, but also launch your career and build an audience so that you can keep doing this and replicating it more successfully over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. So now, let's get back to Katrina for 1 second. If this was for the print run, the Kickstarter was. How do people get a hold of the book if they didn't go through the Kickstarter?
So they can also email me to do a pre-order, the same place. Our pre-orders will be up online, but I can send you a pre-order ability to pick up the book. Or we're going to launch next year, Katrina, at probably around Long Beach. So that's February of next year to coincide with the new year and the new con season. But otherwise, you know, join our mailing list, which is online. You get a free copy of our comic. Email me to get on the pre-order campaign list or buy our other stuff. And for sure, if you buy our other stuff, you will be able to buy Katrina. Ichabod's awesome. Convenience for Diet's awesome. Everything else that we have on our site. Really, our goal is to build a brand that if you like one of our things, you'll very likely like everything else on our site. So I'm very much in control of the entire aesthetic on the site and what we put on there. So if you like that stuff, you'll probably can pick up anything on our site and enjoy it. But
great.
For Katrina specifically, email me for the pre-order campaign or join our mailing list so you can get exclusive offers when we have new content.
Okay, great. Well, Russell, keep up the great work. You're doing wonderful stuff. I like your content, and I like the idea of helping people do better at Kickstarter, because I know some people who should really take this course, so I might suggest it to them.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I think everybody can get a little bit of help. My thing is, even if you run a perfect Kickstarter, you probably still want to take the course just to make sure that it justifies all the things that you've been doing.
Okay. And on that note, we'll close it up. And so, Russell, thank you so much. And we'll look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
I'm talking right now with the creators of Prez, DC's comic, and let's start out with, and you are?
I'm Ben Caldwell, I'm the penciler.
And you are?
Mark Russell, I'm the writer of Prez.
Now, Prez, of course, is a comic book that from the bygone days, and you guys have revived it and put a new spin on it. Do you want to talk about what you've done to update the comic?
Yeah, well, we wanted to put it in a modern context, and I reset the date to 2036, so it'd have all new characters. We wouldn't be confusing it with the universe of the old comic. And also, I wanted, by putting it in the future, to be a commentary on our modern-day politics. Like, this is where we're heading. This isn't, in 20 years, what could be very realistically be the case. Unfortunately, it appears like I was off by 20 years, because it's all happening now.
That's great. Now, as far as like, you're the artist,
yes.
As far as giving it a spin that younger readers might like,
right.
Did you work hard on that to make that happen?
Well, I would say my work in general tends to skew towards younger readers and less traditional comic readers, which I think is one of the reasons they put me on this book. Having said that, I didn't want to. Obviously, it's a science fiction book in that it's set in the future and it raises a lot of questions about changes in society, technology. But like a lot of science fiction, it's a very satirical book. And so I didn't want to get too distracted by the mechanics of that world. So it's a dystopian world, but it's not too overtly dystopian. It's something that you could see very, very soon in our own future in a Cineplex near you. And so I tried to keep an aesthetic that would seem, you know, familiar and bright and open, but had hints of the darker underside.
And one of the great things about the book that I really applaud is you changed Prez from a male to a female, which I thought was great. Do you want to talk about the philosophy behind that and what you've done with the character so she's not just like a standard female lead? Because there seems to be a lot of folks who think that a female lead has to be exactly a certain way, very maternal, very certain kind of things. But your guys aren't doing that. So how are you handling the character now?
Well, I wanted somebody who was, A, very unique and very much themselves. But in doing that, I wanted somebody who was kind of representative of anybody that might be picked out of the phone book. Somebody who's an actual human being and not like an archetype or something. I think one of the problems with comics, superhero comics in general, is that they all kind of like have this sort of embedded ideology where everybody's powerless until this white man with superpowers comes and saves us. Thank you, super white man. And I wanted to say, no, really, the solutions that we're going to be relying upon to save the world are coming from the people in the phone book. That's really what we need. We need to unlock the superpowers of the people in the phone book and get them to work solving the world's big problems instead of waiting for a white dude with a cape to come and settle things for us.
Now, as far as like putting her on the page, did you design her in a specific way? Was she patterned after anybody?
She wasn't patterned after anyone in particular, but my brief was just she's this young woman, she's blonde, and she has this sort of a thrift store punk, I think was the description I was given. So I went with that. I made her so she was sort of ethnically ambiguous because she is a sort of every woman character and our world is changing. So it is less white male, as Mark was saying. And so I wanted a reflection of that. And that's, you know, semiotically, it would be very easy to have this young blonde woman coming off as like the savior Barbie, which I knew was not the direction Mark wanted it to go. And so I played with her a little visually there. And then, you know, really trying to make her a very expressive character. Because I say one of my favorite things from the book with the writing is those moments where, you know, there are moments where she's overwhelmed or whatever. There are other moments where she's just totally self-possessed asshole. And, you know, she'll meet this senator who says, nice to meet you, young, pretty little lady. And she says, nice to meet you, you know, older, kind of wrinkly man. And, you know, she gives as good as she gets, which I really like in a character.
Because we need more characters like that. As I've said, I often get discouraged when females are just maternal. You know, men can be anything in the world, you know, villains, scientists. But women tend to be mothers a lot of the time. So it's nice to see somebody who's a leader who isn't exactly that stereotype. So I'm glad to see that.
Well, I think that one of the things that guys tend not to get about feminism is that the more you put a woman in prescribed roles, the more you also put men in prescribed roles. Because men need to step in. If you're not allowing women to make money, you're not allowing them to take roles of leadership, then those are the roles you're going to have to like take as men, even if you're not particularly suited for them. And I think what we need to, if we're to save a world facing the situations we are now, is for everybody to be able to find their strengths wherever they are and find solutions using their strengths. And so to have these sort of like gender-specific authorized roles that we push people into, whether it's women or men, is a recipe for failure. It's a recipe for extinction, if you ask me.
Well, I agree with you.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I think it's also a bit of a numbers game. And I think, you know, it's something a lot of creators, a lot of publishers, I think DC recognizes, is when you have 90% male characters and just a handful of female characters or non-traditional characters, rightly or wrongly, intentionally or not, those characters end up becoming repositories and, you know, icons for entire groups of people. And so with something like Prez, or just in general, when you have more female characters showing up, then there's just more breathing room for publishers, for creators, for everyone to try different sort of characters and not always have them play the same type over and over. So,
yeah, I like that. Now, as far as supporting characters, what kind of characters have you put around her? Are there people she can trust, people she can't trust? Because, you know, I used to live in Washington, D.C., so I know very well about politics. People will go out there and scream at each other on the floor of the Senate, and then they'll go to the same restaurant and eat together and be friendly. So are those kind of things going to be involved in the story?
Yeah, and I think that one of the reasons why she's able to get so much done in the comics is because she has appointed a cabinet that is not just a bunch of, like, politicians. They're not climbers. They're not looking to use her to further their own careers. They're people who have no political ambitions, so they can be honest about what they really think is best for the nation and for the world. And I think that's the recipe of trust. Who is it whose interests are aligned with yours? If you can find people who are interested in solutions and not interested in their political careers, then you can trust them.
So let's see, what's the latest issue that's come out now?
4 is the latest one's out. 5 is going to drop in a couple weeks.
Very good. And how are you doing as far as the art chores and stuff like that? Because you're keeping up with the monthly comic pretty well?
Pretty much. It was a tight schedule in the beginning, but it's also very compared to a lot of comics, it is a bit graphics intensive. You know, we come up with all these different logos for these companies, and there's all these floating screens and all these visual jokes and things. So that adds to it. But yeah, it's been fun, and so far so good.
As far as what we can see in the future, do you have any hints that we might see in coming issues?
Yeah, there's going to be self-driving cars, like there are now, but it would be operated by Stiri, which is like a version of Siri. And there's going to be meat generators. You put some DNA and some amino acids in there, and you can make a woolly mammoth burger, or you can have dinosaur meat, or whatever you have the DNA for. So, yeah, those are a couple of things you could expect to see in this world.
As far as her politics and things going forward, is she going to grow as a character? Are you looking forward to making her into a, I don't know, what kind of changes will she go through as she goes through the book?
Well, the more she realizes that she can't trust the political process or either party, the more she needs to look outside politics for solutions.
Great, great. And as far as like the art goes, are things going to develop? Are you going to make things grow and change as an artist?
Well, there are certain things. One thing I'd say is Amber Waves, the ubiquitous talk show or news host / edutainment host for the series, she has pretty radical hairstyles and adjustments, and I'm going to start getting creative because I'm running out of options with her hair.
I like her. Sometimes she has like a fortune cookie hair.
Yes.
Yeah. I think, yeah, you kind of hit the fin de sickle of the crazy hairstyle.
I'll find something. And then Beth's going to grow into her role a little more. And her wardrobe's going to start to reflect that, for example. Now that she has a presidential budget and has to show up in public, she'll always have her attitude, but there'll be some changes. And then, of course, I get a lot of help there with that from the inker Mark Morales and the colorist Jeremy Lawson, who really helped bring it to life, this shiny, slightly crazy future. And, you know, going forward, we have 7 more issues to go. We've got a whole 12 issues to get done, so there's going to be a lot of room visually to play with it and see where things go.
Last question, is she going to have a first male, or how's that going to work?
There will be a boyfriend, a love interest, in the back 6 issues. I don't want to say much more than that.
You've already said too much.
Okay. Well, it looks like it's a great book, and so really enjoy it, and so you guys keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike.
I'm talking right now with
Lauren Bierkes
and
Dale Helvelson.
And you guys are doing a book called Survivors Club, which is really interesting, from Vertigo. Why don't you talk a little bit about how you came up with the concept?
Oh, yeah. Lauren had previously done work for Vertigo. She'd worked on Fables, Magic Kingdom, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Hidden Kingdom. And I'm a huge horror fan, so I've been pitching it for years on different horror ideas. And then one day we were sitting on the couch, and I said to her, I've just watched Child's Play. And a thought came to me, what happens to all of those protagonists once the credits roll? So we came up with this idea, what if the 80s horror movies were real, and where are those kids now? And that's basically the thrust of the series.
Which ones will we recognize? Are there other ones that you've created as well, or are basically ones that we know?
Well, we're playing with the major horror tropes, and as Dale has said, it's basically, you know, each of the characters represents a trope. So we've got slasher, we've got J-horror, we've got the portal to hell, lost object, Necronomicon, mixed up with a killer video game, Lost Starfighter, so we've really mashed up a lot of different genres. We've got the creepy neighbor who might be a sex cannibal and have weird stuff happening there, imaginary friends from hell. So we're taking the classic tropes and just really pushing them and subverting them and twisting them. We like to think that what we're trying to do with the comic is that we want to pull the rug out from under your feet, and then you see that the rug's actually made out of human flesh with hair, and those aren't your feet.
Okay, so this is something that we haven't read before, in other words, what you're saying.
Well, hopefully.
One of the interesting things working on this is that people think they know these stories. They've become such a part of popular culture. Everyone knows the story of Jason Voorhees. They know the story of Freddy. They know the story of the Amityville possession. So it's really interesting playing with those expectations. Like, we take it in completely different directions. So it's just a really fun playground that we've kind of, that we have in Survivors Club to explore and freak people out of.
Now, is this out already, or is this coming out soon?
It came out on Wednesday the 7th, so yes, it's out. In store right now.
Okay, Now, if somebody hasn't read it already, should they go like to Comixology, or how else do they get the book? Can they reorder it from DC or Vertigo?
Well, you can pre-order it from your local comic book store. You know, it's always great to have it on your pull list. It's on Comixology. I believe it's on Amazon as well. So wherever good comics are sold.
And this is ongoing, too. This is a monthly book, right?
It's a monthly, yeah. And we're signed up for 24 issues. If it goes really well and lots of people buy it, hopefully it'll run longer. We do have a big plan. So, yeah.
Now, as far as the different characters and stuff on Kitman, doing the artwork on it, did you guys have to come up with a specific, did you refer to previous artwork like that had been done in the 80s? Or did you kind of, since they're grown up, are they looking somewhat differently? Will we recognize?
You know, we're not riffing off specific movies. It's more kind of an idea of the movie. But we did send Ryan Kelly, who's our incredible artist and co-creator on the series, a lot of references. He's not actually a horror fan, so occasionally we'll create clips of videos and send them to him and try to freak him out. We don't want to get him out of the closet as a horror fan. We kind of want to drag him into the closet where the dark things live. But he does just incredible emotional range, and he brings such nuance to the horror. And I think that's specifically because he's not a horror fan, is that he's coming out from a different angle. And sometimes that makes it work out a lot creepier, even than we could have imagined when we were writing the script.
Now, are some people going to survive for a long time? Will we see people come in and out of the series? How will the characters survive? Might somebody disappear for a while? Maybe one come back from the dead even? What kind of things do you have in store for us?
Well, issue two, one of the main characters dies. We open with the character dead.
All right, so that'll be something to look forward to. Any chance that person might come back?
You never know.
Okay, so that'll be a good thing to watch. So you'll keep us on our toes reading it and stuff like that, so that's very good. I'm kind of fascinated, too. One of the aspects of this has to do with these people all meet via the Internet. And, you know, some people say the Internet's not good for anything, but in this case, they actually do this. They bring them together. Is this through, like, a certain website? Do they just kind of bump into each other online? How do they meet?
Well, the main protagonist in the book, Chinzira, she played the video game From Hell when she was a kid, and she's been on the lookout for it returning because she felt that maybe she didn't defeat it, and now she's convinced it's back. She actually finds these people through research on the Internet and kind of contacts them by email, online, and pulls them all together.
But their names are actually already on a list that she finds on the dark web on a very old bulletin board. And when she starts digging into this list to see who these people are, she discovers that all the other people on the list, apart from these six, are missing or dead, that they are the only survivors. There's something holding them together, and something horrible happened to all of them in 1987 when they were kids. And it's different kinds of horrible, and they're all trying to figure out what that was and why that was and why they've been drawn together.
Kind of interesting. Why the 80s? What was it about the 80s that kind of draw you to that? Because, you know, there's been a lot of horror stuff going on, but there was something special about the 80s horror that attracted you guys?
Well, I mean, I'm a huge horror fan. And
we
for
both
me,
are.
Yeah, we both are. But I'm particularly fond of 70s and 80s horror. It seemed to kind of reach a peak in that decade particularly. And it's the stories that people are the most familiar with. I think that's what made it interesting for us. I mean, we're kids of the 80s ourselves. So, yeah, it's just people knowing those stories and then being able to subvert them in interesting ways. So
It's very similar to Fables, actually, Bill Willingham's comic, where he's taking fairy tales and playing with the expectations of your understanding of that. We're doing the same with horror.
And talking about fairy tales, I mean, almost these horror stories almost have become our generation's fairy tales. You know, ask anyone about well-known horror film franchise from the 80s, they're probably able to tell you a fair amount about the story. And that's really fun to play with what people think they know is going to happen.
I think also that, you know, there was a pulp aesthetic, and a lot of those horror movies were also just fun. And that's something we're trying to do in Survivors Club as well, is bring in some black comedy, some very, very dark horror humor as well.
On the scare meter, say 0 to 10, do you do like a horrific thing once or twice in an issue, or what happens as far as how often do you surprise us or scare us like in an issue? Is there a goal you're trying to do?
We try and do it at least kind of twice an issue. You know, like we try to open with something scary, but it could be creepy. Horror is a broad church, so there's a lot of space to play. You know, we could try and do a page turn jump scare, or we could just do creeping dread, which is something we both really enjoy as well. I think one of the things that we're both averse to is torture porn and gore porn. So there is blood, it's horror after all, but we're not really interested in watching someone get flayed alive or having their eyeballs scooped out with like an ice cream scoop. Because it's kind of dull, actually. It's a bit tedious. It's not actually that scary. So we really like to push the boundaries of everything else.
Are you going to like flashback at times to see what happened to them in the 80s? How are you going to handle that? Is it going to be like sepia tone art? How are you going to do those things?
Yeah, well, I mean, all the survivor stories play out in the present day and the past. So we have flashbacks, glimpses to what happened to them in 1987.
In every issue.
And then you'll probably have glimpses between that period and present day.
And Ryan, the way we handled it art-wise is that Ryan draws it in an ink wash style, and the colors are like slightly differently graded, and it just looks beautiful. It looks absolutely amazing. But every issue has a big flashback, which shows you something about the characters. They're all puzzle pieces that we're putting together.
This is already out. Is it going to come out like the first week of every month? Is that when it's going to appear?
Yes, first week of every month. You can pre-order it, put it on your pull list, get it from your local comic book store or Comixology.
You know, this screams television show to me. Is there any chance that if somebody, a TV or a studio was to approach you, would you guys be willing to turn this into a TV show?
Yes, absolutely. That'd be amazing. You know, and like, yeah. And I think comics lends itself to TV shows in particular because, you know, you're basically doing the storyboard.
There's like a whole horror channel out there and stuff like that. I could see this being on there quite regularly and be one of their regular shows. So I think it would be a great program to do that. It has all kinds of appeal on all different levels since you're covering all these different things.
We have our bloody fingers crossed.
Okay. Well, it looks great and it sounds great. And so thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Talking right now with Jeff King, an accomplished TV producer and who has now delved into the world of comics, including DC's big event, Convergence, and now a new book, Telus, which has just been released. How are you doing today, Jeff?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Really good, really good. Why don't you tell people the great story about how you got to write Convergence? I just thought that was one of the best things I've ever heard.
I was working in television, wound up at DC, met Dan Didio, and we fell to talking about things that we loved about television. And it happened to come up that they had a big event that was in the offing. And was I interested in pitching into it because it sounded like my skills as a TV writer might fit with what they were planning to do. And by that point, Dan Juergens, Brian Azzarello, Scott Snyder, they had all been involved in the event in various ways. And that serendipitous opportunity, that meeting with Dan, turned into an opportunity to write Convergence.
Now, you were on a tour of the offices right when this happened.
That's correct.
Yeah, this is an amazing thing. Did you happen to be in the right place at the right time?
Sometimes that's the way life works.
So how was it to start off with doing a big event like Convergence, which has basically redefined the DC universe?
It was like being dropped into the deep end of a pool and drinking from a fire hose at the same time. For me, growing up, my experience with DC was mostly the classic Kirby stuff. Forever People, the Battleman, Demon. Obviously, I knew Batman and Superman were, but some of the rich history and especially the transition across Flashpoint, those were all things that I really had to catch up on. The New 52 was something that I really had to catch up on. But fortunately, I was standing on the shoulders of a lot of giants who had already begun working on the event. So for me, a lot of my timing was making the connection between the end of Future's End and the end of World's End, Earth 2 World's End, and what was going to happen coming out of Convergence. So it was setting the table for society and reconnecting those characters with that universe, and then finding our way through the story to reset the multiverse and to reset Crisis, which was a huge responsibility and so difficult to do. We had a 9-issue miniseries, but it could have been 90. I mean, we're still going to be writing books about that. And one of the fun things about Telos is it came out of a series of conversations that began with people who wanted to write stories about things that happened during Convergence that weren't necessarily written about. You know, we all wanted to tell the story about what Supergirl experience when she went back to Reset Crisis? Did she not turn around when Dr. Light called out at that critical moment, for example? Those stories are all yet to be told, but what came out of it were the three sort of post-convergence books that directly connect to it. Dan Jurgens has the Lois and Clark Superman book that's coming out, and that's sort of 9 years after Convergence. In our universe, Lois and Clark are in hiding. There's a Justice League. There's another Superman. And so how do you be that guy with that knowledge in this world trying to raise a child? Telos happens basically 9 minutes after. But unlike Lois and Clark, it's set out in the outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy. He's out in sort of in Legion country, because Brainiac gave him that sliver of his ultimate shell so that he could travel the multiverse and reconnect with his family. But like everything with Brainiac, there was a bit of a hitch. Where Telos went, there was no planet and there was no family. So now he's coming back to get the truth out of him. And of course, doesn't trust Brainiac, but he's super powered, so he has a huge advantage. And that's going to get him involved in a rebellion that's taking place on Kalu, which is the home planet of Brainiac, which is now under the thumb of Computo, who's a classic Legion character, and who's the leader of the computer tyrants, the AI that Brainiac established when he left prior to Convergence to go begin his exploration of the universe. So.
Did you develop Telos yourself, or was that like a combination of people coming together to make the character?
It was really a combination of people, and we're going to find out a little bit more about his true history in Telos issue number 2. So all that is to be revealed.
Now, Telos number 1, of course, is out. Have you gotten any reaction to the book yet?
I've been getting some really great reactions. It's fun for people to read. The art is amazing. People love it. It's a very straightforward, simple story. Unlike a lot of number one issues, it doesn't go deep into the mythology of the world or setting up a tapestry of characters. It's really about two guys going head-to-head who really don't like each other very much, but they're forging an uneasy alliance for what's to come.
Now, what was the reaction that you got to Convergence? Because, you know, that's your big thing, your very first thing. That must have been kind of nerve-wracking when it was coming out. You were anxious to see what people thought of it.
Totally. And what I learned from Convergence is that there are so many huge fans who have such specific loves and such strong attachments to certain characters that you can never please everyone, and you can never give every character enough screen time. So what you hope to do is to do as honor the characters that you have time to tell story with, and hope that as the months and years go down the road, that other creators pick up those stories of those characters that weren't told and tell them.
I'm kind of interested. What did you think about what was going to happen after Convergence? That all these stories are all part of DC continuity instead of like with the New 52, they pared it down into just a small continuity. What was your reaction when you found out that? You couldn't have been in that decision, but when they told you that, what was your reaction to that?
I thought it was terrific. Because it seems to me, I mean, only because what I often am working on in TV series is a huge, deep mythology, sometimes spanning thousands of years. So it's not just the life cycle of a human life, it's the life cycle of societies, of galaxies and universes. But I always feel like you need to have a small group of perspective characters on whatever that passage of time is, because I feel like that's what makes life and death important. And so even if every choice is like a champagne glass full of bubbles and the bubbles are always going up and you can choose one or choose one or choose one or choose the next one and there are multiverses and multiverses, at the end of the day you're experiencing one at a time. So I thought that was a great idea, because what it meant is every character could kind of come into an enormous canon or continuity. But I know there are a lot of fans who really like concrete continuities and certain timelines, and they really like to know which characters know each other and why and how that all works. So it's a not insignificant task for the new creators to figure out how to integrate all of the different versions of every character into their stories. Telos is going to do a certain amount of that. The Lois and Clark book is going to do a certain amount of that that Dan's writing. Dan Abnett's Titans book is definitely going to do that, bring together different generations.
Last question. Are you coordinating with the other folks in the other books, or are you guys each doing like a separate book, a separate story?
You know, we're all telling the story that we want to tell, but there's a high level of coordination in editorial, and they really encourage us to talk to each other. So, you know, for example, you know, we all have a sense of what each other is doing, and for example, Tom King is working in the kind of larger Legion universe with the Omega Man, and that's a great book, and he's doing a wonderful job. So I have a sense of where he's going, for example.
Well, that looks great, Jeff, and I hope it's a big success and we get to see more from you. So thanks very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's it for this episode. Be back next week when I'll have another great interview with another wonderful comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.